Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From the green space here at WNYC, it's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show. Advice to Egypt, what happens after a revolution? Good morning, everyone. You're already listening, and if you would like to watch us here in the green space, we are streaming live video at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. And there are many great people to look at if you decide to stream the video. We have guests who have lived through, reported on, or studied revolutions from all over the world, from India and the Philippines to El Salvador and Cuba to Iran, South Africa, and the former Soviet Empire, and beyond. They'll compare notes on how some revolutions turn out well and some not so well, with an eye toward helping Egypt. And we have other special guests, such as historian Simon Shama and democracy expert Benjamin Barber, foreign affairs editor Gideon Rose, and Egyptian-born blogger Mona Eltahawy, and more. But first, just for 2 minutes, let's connect this room with Cairo. With us on the phone is Lynn Atala, managing editor of the newspaper Al-Masri Al-Yum. Lynn, can you hear us? Hello from New York. That's Lena, can you hear us?
More or less. It's not very clear, but I can hear it.
Okay. Lena, tell us, where are you right now and what's happening?
Right now we are in our office, which is a few meters away from Tahrir Square. The square is a little bit but also people from Bolton are marching towards different locations, the two main locations they are marching to, the television building and the First Nation Palace in the City Office neighborhood in the east of Cairo.
All right, our line is not very good. We may have to cut this short, but tell us where the protest movement can go now, in your opinion, with Mubarak digging in.
I think that the protest movement, the protesters on the street, are determined to continue.
All right. Unfortunately, I don't think we can understand a word, so we're going to try to get back to Lena in Cairo, and we thank her in any case, managing editor of Al-Masri Al-Yum. With me now on the green space stage, foreign affairs magazine editor Gideon Rose. He was on the National Security Council staff in the Clinton administration, and Egyptian-born columnist and furious tweeter these last few weeks, Mona Eltahawy, who has been a Middle East correspondent for Reuters and others, among other things. And again, listeners, you can watch Mona and Gideon and this whole event live on your computer right now if you'd like. Go to our politics website. It's afreecountry.org for live streaming video. It's Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution. Hello, Mona. Hello, Gideon. And before we get to the big historical picture and advice from revolutions all over the world, help us understand what the situation is in Egypt right now. Mona, how did the army inform the world yesterday that the protesters' demands would be met and then have Mubarak come out and not resign? What do you think actually happened there? A power struggle, a coordinated manipulation of the people? What?
I would say, in two words, a combination of Mubarak. The entire nation of Egypt was punked by the Mubarak regime,
punked.
If everybody understands what punk means in reference to the MTV show. But also, it was a very sadistic move, I think, on the Mubarak regime, because they knew all along that everybody was waiting for some kind of announcement, that a senior NDP official, the head of the NDP, essentially, a man called Hossam Badrawi, had told Channel 4 News and so many other news media, Hosni Mubarak will step down today. So they knew that this was what was expected. So whether it was a power struggle behind the scenes, whether he changed his mind, whether he really is this sadistic person that I believe he is, it obviously didn't turn out that way. And so I feel when Mubarak got on live TV yesterday, he was essentially throwing a grenade into Tahrir Square, because it's been a peaceful, beautiful, pure movement that has resisted violence at all costs. You're watching basically nonviolent resistance circa 2011 in Cairo, Egypt, in a part of the world that people never associate with nonviolence. As an Arab, as an Egyptian, I'm sick and tired of the stereotypes of my people being violent and loving the violent strong leader. Here people saying we are remaining peaceful, and here's Mubarak pushing them to the edge.
So he hopes, in your opinion, for some fringe violence that will allow him to have an excuse to violently crush the whole thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's tried everything. He tried these thugs that he would put onto the streets of Cairo. He tried the security forces. It didn't work. He pulled them off the streets. He sent the armed forces. The armed forces, we spent days now discussing, are they neutral? Does their neutrality mean that they're on Mubarak's side? Whose side are they on, really? But the armed forces, remember, they control the military police that have been detaining people. And we're hearing, you know, of all kinds of horrific torture. So we know where the army stands now. What is happening in Egypt now, I think, is he's trying to push people to the brink so that they are violent, so we can crack down. But I'm hoping to see young, honorable soldiers in the armed forces, and we've heard of a few of them joining the demonstrations. One man actually tweeted from outside of Egyptian television today saying that there was an army general standing there guarding television building, crying, looking at the demonstrators. You can feel that among the armed forces there's a real kind of a real dilemma. Whose side do we take? Egypt or Hosni Mubarak? And I think that's what's at stake.
Gideon, some of the timeline yesterday, and this was all breaking live on our show, so we were kind of narrating this in real time, 10:15 a.m., military officials say the army will issue communique shortly that will meet protesters' demands. That was an AP bulletin at 10:15. 10:30, Cairo, AP, the ruling party chief, Hossan Badrawi, who you just mentioned, tells the Associated Press he expects Mubarak to address the nation and make an announcement that will satisfy their demands. 11:05 a.m., Washington, AP, CIA chief Leon Panetta, strong likelihood that Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak will step down today. 11:15 a.m., BBC, Egyptian information minister says President Mubarak is not stepping down and everything reported in the media is a rumor, says Reuters. That turned out to be right 4 hours later when Mubarak finally spoke. So how did the entire world, in your opinion, get one impression while something else was in the works? Punked, as Mona says, pranked, or something else?
Well, you know, the short answer, which is, of course, deeply unsatisfying, is that nobody actually knows yet. We'll find out the story later on. I don't think this was a deliberate bait and switch, because it was stupid on their part, because it's not going to work. It only stoked the desire to see Mubarak go, so that it created an even greater sort of letdown when the speech was actually heard. I wasn't actually expecting him to step down, and I was expecting some kind of stalemate. So I was quite surprised when my wife, you know, called me yesterday morning and said, "Have you heard that Mubarak's stepping down?" And I was like, "Wow, really? Okay, my analysis is totally off." So I was not surprised when it ultimately didn't happen. But the short answer is nobody knows anything, and everybody, even in the highest levels of the White House, is watching TV, listening to radio, following tweets. Someone asked me what they're doing in the White House during a crisis like this, and I said they're going like this, clicking channels and trying to figure out what's happening on TV, or now they're looking at their tweets and so forth. And you know, the story here is really about Egypt and what's happening there, and the outsiders don't really have much of an ability to affect the situation.
Biden to Obama, let's see what Andrea Mitchell is saying. Huh? Let's begin to include our room full of other guests on this point. Advice to Egypt. Does this moment look familiar to anyone in the House from your country's experience or from a country you have covered or studied? A people's revolution is in progress and seems close to success, but gets stuck when the dictator digs in. Does where we are right now sound familiar to anyone? Can anyone think of an analogous situation? Are there discernible stages in revolutions? Who can speak to this moment? Who has any echoes of history right now in your head from this? Sir. And please let me ask everybody all morning, actually, to please identify yourselves as you start so that the radio audience can know who you are.
I'm Yusuf Ibrahim. I happen to be the bureau chief in Iran during the Iranian Revolution for the New York Times. And it was my first foreign assignment. And this looks very much like a phase of the Iranian Revolution. It is definitely an uprising, very much a middle class, and other classes are joining. I expect the clergy to join soon, and I expect the poor to join soon. And then the next phase will be who will dominate this revolution. But we are in the early phase of a revolution that resembles very much 78 in Iran against the Shah.
78, a year before 79. Was there a
the Iranian revolution took the better part of 2 years, basically 78, 79. Khomeini did not arrive until February. We are not there yet. We are in the phase where this revolution is being shaped, designed. The various elements, the players are coming in. It's very interesting. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood hasn't played its card yet, clearly out of fear to be perceived as trying to dominate the revolution.
Anyone else? Raise your hands and we'll bring the mic right over. Yes, right down here. Please identify yourself for the radio audience.
I'm Ann Nelson. I teach at Columbia University, and I've worked in several countries that have been through revolutions, and I've been in various stages. I would say of any of them, it would remind me of Tiananmen Square in China, which did not culminate, and it would remind me of the Philippines, which did culminate in a shift in the presidency, but not an immediate change in the power structure.
Ma'am, right behind her.
I'm Nefertiti Diar. I teach at Barnard College, and I was in the Philippine Revolution in 1986, and it's the whole thing happening in Egypt feels extremely familiar. In the part, the wooing of the military, a very divided, politicized military that had grown hugely under a very long dictatorship is extremely familiar. And I would say that was one of the key factors in both the shift in the and the lack of a fundamental change in the power structure, a divided military that sought to reconcile itself and that ultimately betrayed the people who came to its rescue and who wooed it. And I think these elements are extremely familiar to me.
Was there a moment like this in that people power revolution led by Corazon Aquino? The color was yellow. Many of these seem to have a color. I don't think they have a color in Egypt. Mona,
we were avoiding colors and flowers.
but there a stuck moment like this that then needed to get unstuck?
There was a stuck moment, and it had to do with whether the dictator was going to leave or not. And, of course, the U.S. was fundamental to that departure.
Ferdinand Marcos.
Yes,
in that
Ferdinand
case.
Marcos was flown off. The difference was also in that the substantial part of the military had, for their own interests, joined the people, and that the pro-Marcos forces had not assaulted the people because of the way in which people appealed, backroom deals. I mean, very many complex reasons that the military of the Marcos regime did not attack, that was a fundamental difference.
And that's what we hope will be the case going forward in Egypt, as it has been so far, the army not attacking, and as Mona was hoping, more and more people defecting. I also want to invite the other Egyptian New Yorkers in the room. Who among you would like to speak right now and give us your thoughts or your feelings or analysis, your reactions to anything the guests have been saying about the present moment so far, sir? And please identify yourself.
Kebab Cafe in Astoria. I did live in the same movement, the young Egyptian doing today in the 70s, Antar Nasser, and he was as tolerant as Mubarak today, and he was as manipulative as him today.
As tolerant, in other words, there was a moment under Nasser in the 70s where a democracy movement broke out. It grew. There was restraint on the part of the government in terms of no mass violence.
Yes, and this happened in certain Alexandria colleges. And today, it seems like the most intelligent and most organized move against Mubarak. And the only thing we can support is the young Egyptian today and back them up. And it shows that Egyptian movements are more civilized than lots of other wars. And I would never call it a revolution, because a revolution is a word of the 50s, always associated with violent Egyptians. They show that they civilized, and no violence ever happened in Egypt today but from the government of Hosni Mubarak. No bank has been robbed, no religious institution has been burned, and all happened because of manipulative brain. And this is, he's just a burned and wounded dictator, and he has to go yesterday.
How about the way the 70s situation ended? How did it get diffused? How did Nasser wind up remaining in power?
Nasser played his card right at the time, and Nasser had the upper hand is by moving most of the politicians anytime he wanted, because he wanted to be the only one at the top. And he tried, and as a matter of fact, one of the guys we brought back to the surface at the time was Sadat. Sadat almost appeared during Nasser's time. Doesn't mean that Sadat was not as dictator as Mubarak or Hosni or the old. We are not only 30 years in a very bad situation. We have been all for 60 years since Nasser's time. And this is when most of the intellectual Egyptians start to leave Egypt, because you could not go anywhere else.
Mona, do you also hear a resonance with something that happened and that ultimately failed in the 1970s?
There have been several attempts against various military dictators, as the gentleman just mentioned. I mean, since 1952, a series of military men who basically just took off their uniforms and put on suits, but have been all along military men, have ruled Egypt. And, you know, we've heard of, you know, the bread riots also in 80s, I think, no, 70s, 80s. Someone here can correct me. I'm not getting any sleep. So the bread riots, you know, other attempts to basically rise up against these military men who've ruled Egypt both as military men and through a police state, and have always been successfully crushed. And I think what we're seeing now is an alignment of groups that we never saw talking or meeting, and that has made it possible for all these people to go out. So you're seeing something that started online, basically in the virtual space, by this very tech-savvy, what I call Generation Facebook. And they managed to take this virtual dissent, or this dissent from the virtual space into the real space, because that was the real challenge, and connect it to so many other groups in Egyptian society who have long resented the Mubarak regime. And what you're seeing now is workers and unions joining. And just today, I mean, Yusuf was mentioning the clergy. Just today, I was hearing from people in Tahrir Square who are going to Friday prayers. And this is very interesting, that clerics who were giving the Friday prayer sermon were saying the revolution is a good and pure thing, and you are doing the right thing. Now, compare that to 5 or 6 weeks ago, when the Egyptian regime, when Mubarak's regime basically was instructing the state-appointed clerics to condemn what was happening in Tunisia, and to tell people, because Egyptians were mimicking the self-immolation that started the Tunisian uprising, a young man called Mohamed Bouazizi. So basically you saw a series of dictators across the region instructing their clerics to tell people this is wrong and good Muslims obey authority. You're not seeing that anymore. You're hearing from Christian priests that the revolution is good. We have a Coptic Christian Egyptian who can tell you much more in the audience. But you're hearing from Friday prayers today from people, and people who are leaving Al-Azhar and going, you know, the institution of Sunni Muslim learning. So my point is, all these other kind of attempted uprisings against these various dictators in the past were not able to coalesce and connect with Egyptian society at large, but you're seeing that happen now as more and more people join the
uprising.
Gideon
Rose?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that the Philippines parallel is an interesting one is, of course, there the revolution and the uprising was taking place against an American-backed regime in the same way that it is in Egypt. So you have a classic situation of what in the policy world we call the friendly tyrant problem, which is the United States makes a deal with a local strongman because it serves U.S. interests in a variety of ways, but that regime is not necessarily either beneficial to the interests of the public at large in the country or particularly liked. And then at a certain point, the contradictions in American policy come to the fore, and then it faces U.S. policymakers with this very difficult choice. Do you support the guy who is actually helping serve your interests, or do you get on what you consider the right side of history and move that forward? In the same way that ultimately we helped ease out Marcos after supporting him for a very long time, I would expect, frankly, that we will do the same thing essentially with Mubarak, because the costs to the American position of backing a despised regime, especially if it really did try to crack down violently, will be greater than even the sunk costs of the U.S.-Egyptian collaboration in the past.
Fascinating. Live from the Green Space, it's Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution, with a room full of guests representing past revolutions from all over the world. You can watch us as we feed live video of this event at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. You can also call in. Our phones are open, as on any other day, 212-433-WNYC. We invite anyone else in particular who is Egyptian-American or who has experience yourself with any other revolution at any other time. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take a caller right now. a cab driver, he says. Now, Maury in Manhattan, thank you so much for calling. Hello.
How you doing, sir?
Good. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Good. I'm calling on from Mali, West Africa, and we had a similar situation in 1992. And I think it takes great courage for someone on the side of the president to just do a coup to end the situation. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
That's one way to do it. Thank you very much. Well, Mona, who's in charge in Egypt right now? We were reporting yesterday, we were really quoting people who were analyzing yesterday, that a military coup had, in effect, taken place in the morning, and the army was ushering Mubarak out of power.
It's a great question. Everybody in Egypt would like to know who's in power right now. Just before I came to the show, there was news that some presidential or statement coming out of the presidency was about to hit the airwaves. We're not really sure. I mean, essentially what Mubarak did yesterday was he snuck in this kind of 1.5 sentences saying, I've delegated power to my vice president, but in essence remained president. So what I'm hearing from Tahrir Square is people are saying, no, we wanted to get rid of Mubarak, and now we have two Mubaraks, because we have Mubarak and we have the vice president, Omar Suleiman. And all along, their goal was to get rid of the regime. So they were thinking, well, what are the armed forces going to do now? The armed forces issued a statement this morning saying we are essentially backing Mubarak and ensuring free and fair elections in September. So basically, it seems to be the status quo. But what really worries me about what's happening in D.C. is that people, the administration seems to be buying this line that Mubarak has ceded all power. I mean, I'm trying my best on the airwaves here to tell people he has not. He remains president, and Omar Suleiman remains his right-hand man. Nothing really has changed. He still controls what's going on.
They're not buying that in Washington. Well, we have to take a break. But when we come back, Gideon, I want to ask you, are they really buying that in Washington? Didn't the Obama administration issue a statement that says this is not an immediate, meaningful, nor sufficient sign of reform? And then we'll continue to bring in everybody from the audience. Egyptian-American gentleman over there wants to talk. Benjamin Barber wants to talk. And listeners, you can keep calling in, 212-433-WNYC, live from the Green Space. It's Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution, on WNYC.
ضد الحكومة وحبل الظلم طويل ضد الحكومة وعندي ألف دليل دمك مسيحينه قتلك محللينه وطنك مبهدلينه دينك مستهدفينه صوتك هم مجادلينه حقك كمان
Live from the Green Space, it's Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution, with a room full of guests representing past revolutions from all over the world, and a group of Egyptian Americans who've been good enough to come in. You can watch us as we feed live video of this event at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. We'll go to more of your phone calls at 212-433-9692. We have on our stage right now Foreign Affairs magazine editor Gideon Rose and Egyptian-born columnist and tweeter these last few weeks extraordinaire, Mona El-Tahawi. And where we left off, Gideon, was Mona saying that they don't get it in Washington. They still seem to accept at face value the statement by Mubarak yesterday that he was handing over power to Suleiman, and that means something. But again, Obama issued a statement afterwards saying what Mubarak did was not an immediate, meaningful, nor sufficient sign of reform. So what role do you think the United States is playing right now?
Right now, the United States is playing a watching and trying to catch up with events and trying not to get on the wrong side of whatever ultimately happens. And it's a very difficult challenge. I don't think they're covering themselves in glory, and they sometimes should shut up rather than constantly issuing new statements with every new development. But they are grappling with a legitimate problem, which is the United States is ultimately going to deal with Egypt in a very serious and important way, no matter how this plays out. And they don't want to ultimately – they want to use their pressure to have this go as smoothly and constructively as possible in a liberal direction while maintaining some degree of stability. But since nobody really knows what's going to happen on the ground, different people in Washington are backing different horses. The military is very comfortable with the Egyptian military. The old line Arabists and the State Department are comfortable with the old regime. And there are a lot of people who obviously want the demonstrators to succeed. So no one really knows in Washington any more than anybody else knows any place else.
Let's go to this gentleman in the front row. Hi.
Hi, Hisham Malidi, an Egyptian New Yorker. You want to know who's ruling Egypt now? It's Benjamin Netanyahu.
And basically, my own analysis is that Mubarak is doing all these. He doesn't himself want to stay, but Israel and the United States, from behind the scenes, want to salvage the situation as much as possible to keep the strategic alliances between Egypt and the U.S. and Israel without much loss.
Israel may want that, but how could Israel influence at this point? I think we just heard from Gideon how little power the United States feels it has. Seems like Israel is in a similar position.
There were some reports in the beginning that Netanyahu and the Israeli government, the Saudi government, and some other Arab autocracies in the Gulf lobbied hard in the United States to keep Mubarak in place, at least temporary, until because they're afraid. I mean, if it happens in Egypt, it will happen in their places. Egypt is not Vegas. It's not going to stay in Egypt. So, you know.
Gideon, a quick reaction to that?
I agree that they're lobbying, but I think that you called it just right, Brian, which is that what they want to happen is not necessarily what's going to happen. And the question will be, again, as with Marcos, there were a lot of interests. We're talking about the Philippines. There were a lot of deep-seated interests with Marcos and the Marcos regime, and ultimately the United States eased its path out. And so the question will be, Washington doesn't want to jump off the Mubarak course until it was clear that there was another one there. They didn't want to jump off the regime until they know what's going to come next. And they're watching and waiting to see what happens on the ground in Egypt and how this stalemate that's currently there will break.
By the way, we're hearing from ABC News that they believe Mubarak will speak again soon. So
enough.
If that
enough.
Happens, enough. Mona says, oh, you've spoken enough. So what will he say one day later? If it happens, we will bring it to you. Benjamin Barber, democracy expert from Demos. Hi.
Hi. Quick point about Netanyahu. Someone ought to call him and tell him he's ruling Egypt, because if he knows that, he may have the courage to then go back to negotiating with the Palestinians again. I think he certainly wishes he were, but I don't think that's the case. But I want to make a more general point in answer to your question about revolutions and the anatomy of revolutions, a title by Crane Britton 40 years ago, a marvelous book, still worth looking at, called An Anatomy of Revolution, because there are two kinds of revolution, very, very different. And the first is easy, not so successful. The second is hard and rarely succeeds. The first is political revolutions, where you change a regime, change a government, change a president. And those happen a lot, and they give the appearance of fundamental change, but because they don't touch the underlying socioeconomic structures and infrastructure of a society, they don't really make that much difference. On the other hand, there's an attempt to actually overthrow an infrastructure and a socioeconomic structure. The French and Russian revolutions were the two great historical examples of an attempt to completely transform a socioeconomic and ruling structure of a society. Both of them ended in failure. The French Revolution with the rise of Napoleon and then the restoration of the monarchy. The Russian Revolution with the success of the Bolshevik Party, which did indeed destroy the old regime but brought in a new regime very different. The revolution often held up as the model of a successful political revolution is ours. The American Revolution, which was a political revolution, changed rule from London to rule from Philadelphia, eventually Washington. A political revolution succeeded. Hannah Arendt always boasted about the America's great political revolution as a success. Here's the problem. We did not undergo the socioeconomic revolution that was necessary, the transformation from a cotton slave economy to a manufacturing urban economy. That took another 80 years and a bloody civil war. That was really the second American Revolution, nowhere near as successful. So what I want to suggest is that in looking at this, one of the questions to pose to Egypt is, are you going to end up with a regime change, a very simple one, just Suleiman or Tantawi, one of the generals taking over, or perhaps even some guys from the parties ruling, or are you going to change the structure that allows millions and millions of young people to have no jobs, be educated without jobs? That's going to be much tougher. I think that's highly improbable.
Exactly. And we're going to talk for the entire second hour of the program, more with you, also with Simon Shama and Jeff Goodwin and others, about exactly that question, advice for Egypt for after the revolution. We thought today might actually be after the revolution when we were planning this, but we're spending the first part of the program on what do you do when the revolution gets stuck? And ma'am, hi.
Christian, Coptic Orthodox faith, and I feel that the Copts and the Christians in Egypt under Mubarak regime have suffered a lot, been slaughtered on so many occasions. Name it, Al-Kush, Al-Umraniyya, the Qadisiyin, Nag Hammadi, all those events were under the Mubarak regime. And I believe that most of the Christians, I can't speak on behalf of all of them, but I know that people want freedom, and the Copts in Egypt want their basic rights to be able to build a church, to be able to have their rights to be rightly represented by their own people. And I also believe that Mubarak's condescending tone to call me his daughter, I am not his daughter. My father was a noble, honest man, who passed away a long time ago, and I have never voted for Mubarak. We've never talked about politics in Egypt, even in the most affluent schools, and we were not allowed to speak about politics, and I just do not want Mubarak to be there because he is not legitimate.
Do you think that that line resonated with anybody in Egypt yesterday? I certainly cringed when I watched him say, I am the father speaking to you as my children, to the nation. Certainly the protesters hated that at that moment. But do you think that has resonance in parts of Egypt, even now with Hosni Mubarak? Or is he just that out of touch?
People who are used to the 1960s politics might take that. People are in a shock. There is a lot of psychology behind this. People all of a sudden became free. They couldn't speak before, and then all of a sudden they can speak. But I can tell you that we want freedom. We want a secular government. We want a government that is good for Egyptians. Egyptians deserve much better.
Do you think, as an Egyptian Christian, that because there is a sizable Christian population, I think about 15%, is that right?
15 to 20%. It depends on the statistics that Mubarak controls. Yes.
So a sizable Christian minority. That means it is more likely to wind up with a secular government or a non, what we generally call Islamist government, as in Iran, because of the nature of the population?
What I'm seeing, just sitting and watching the screens of the TV, I'm not seeing this as an Islamic movement. I'm seeing this as a secular movement. I'm seeing this as an organic grassroots movement that speaks on behalf of most Egyptians.
Youssef Ibrahim, former New York Times bureau chief during the revolution in Iran, you called into the show the other day expressing concern that the Muslim Brotherhood would try to move it toward an Islamist revolution. Do you think that the nature of the population helps prevent against that?
We don't know yet, but what is very remarkable about this revolution is in the past 2 or 3 weeks, we haven't heard the word Palestine. We haven't heard armed struggle. We haven't heard Islamism show itself in the revolution at all. It truly has been a cry for liberty and freedom and getting rid of an oppressive regime which has been around essentially for 60 years if you consider that the army officers took power in 1952. Most of us really never voted in anything that even resembles a free election. So at this moment, which is a priceless moment, this is a purely 100% Egyptian revolution on which neither the Palestinians nor the Arab world have imposed any other non-Egyptian agenda.
Thank you. Let's see if we can go to another caller who objects to the use of the word revolution, and that is Ali in Manhattan. Let's see if Ali is there. Ali, you're on the air. Hello.
Ali, Brian, thank you very much for your guests. Some of your guests, they know what the meaning of revolution means. I was in Iran at the time of revolution, which you guys say revolution. It was not revolution. There has not been any revolution after Russian revolutions. Your guess was completely right. These all are uprising. What are the reasons behind the uprising? They all say democracy and all of this nonsense. Middle East is Islamic culture. There is no democracy. There's equality. What is happening, these strong people or armies, they take over. What happened in Egypt, Nasser and Muslim Brotherhood, they made a deal to get rid of the king. And they did. But then Nasser screwed them up. And the same thing happened in Iran. When the revolution happened, people thought they're going to get rid of the king, but they didn't. They got the same type of a structure and the different people. The colors were changed, but the system was the same.
Ali,
and the same thing happened in Egypt. The people in Egypt are very naive to see that this uprising is going to get them anywhere.
Ali, thank you very much for your call.
Are not there, and that's what my point is.
Any last thought, Gideon and Mona, before we rotate you off?
I want to play off
other people on about the word revolution or anything else that Ali said.
I want to play off something that Yusuf said about the external context. I mean, we look at these things in an internal context within the country in question, and then there's also an international and a global context in which they play out ideologically, politically, and so forth. And I think that one of the fascinating things about this is exactly what Yusuf was saying, which is the fact that it's playing out in a relatively actually benign and non-ideological and non-contentious broader international and global context. And what I mean by that is, okay, the Cold War is over, and so the pressure on the U.S. to force this into some kind of exterior confrontation aspect is not there. The fact is that the Islamist challenge is not seen by many people outside certain quarters as a viable solution to modernity. And so even if there are pressures that way in the region in some quarters, it's not really as much of an alternative possibility for going forward. And so all this, I think, bodes in some respects well. Not so much that it's going to work out wonderfully and happily, but this is ultimately about political development inside Egypt. And the question of how you actually create a modern regime that can serve the interests of its people and move forward. And the fact that it will ultimately play out according to the local power struggles and so forth that are there and the local interests is actually a good thing, because it's not going to be polluted by some of the broader and sillier and unhelpful contexts that often get in the way of the basic story that's at issue here.
Mona, a word on Ali's take that we shouldn't be saying revolution, we should say revolt against the regime. Does it matter? Do you embrace the word revolution?
Absolutely, wholeheartedly. I mean, I love how people who aren't Egyptian are turning around and telling Egyptians, especially those who are spending day after day in the freezing cold, standing up to Mubarak and his thugs. I love how they tell them, you're being naive. I mean, I think they're being incredibly empowered. They're being incredibly mature. We're seeing a coming of age of politics in Egypt in which people have collectively risen up, revolted, and are staging a revolution. I embrace all three words and are saying business is no longer as usual. And not just that, but influencing the entire region. Before Tunisia, we've spoken about this before, Brian, before Tunisia, people said, nah, never going to happen. After Tunisia, that's it. No way. And especially Egypt. And now it's happening in Egypt. People can't believe it. They want to keep telling us you're being naive, and we want to keep telling them, no, we've grown up. We've opened our eyes. We're finally speaking, and just butt out of it and mind your own business so we can take care of this.
Okay, Mona, where does it not go? Where does it not go next? If everything, I agree with everything you just said, and the smart money was not on Tunisia, the smart money was on stopping at Tunisia, the smart money wasn't on not playing out even as fast as it has. Mm-hmm. But at some point, this is not going to be, I think, an entire regional uprising. So where does it not go beyond Egypt? If I had to predict, I would say it doesn't go to Saudi Arabia, that stays essentially calm, at least for the near to midterm. Eventually, sure, but not.
Well, the Gulf monarchies are a case in their own. I'm thinking of the countries that aren't monarchies, and you're already seeing reactions where the Algerian, who's been in power since 1999, says, I'm going to lift emergency law, and the Yemeni saying, my son isn't going to run anymore. So you're seeing a lot of preemptive attempts to stop this kind of baton. You know, it's like a relay. Tunisia gave us this great baton. We're running with it, and we're going to hand it over. I mean, on Twitter yesterday, I said, hey, you guys, who wants our baton? And I had friends from all over the Arab world saying, me, Sudan, Libya, Algeria. This is an incredible time in the Arab world. So I want everyone to stop telling us we're being naive. We're being kick-ass, okay?
Please thank Mona Eltahawy, columnist, and Gideon Rose, Foreign Affairs Magazine editor. We will continue in a moment with the rest of you. Live from the Green Space, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Advice to Egypt, what happens after a revolution?
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, for Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Bouazizi lit the poof. And it slowly ignited the fire within Arab people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis to New York.
We are listening to some relevant hip-hop music along the way today. Earlier, Rami Donjuan, Egyptian hip-hop artist singing about revolution. Egyptian singer Kaltoum. She was an Egyptian singer, one of the most famous in the Middle East. Rappers Omar Effendim, The Narcissist, Freeway, and deaf poet Amir Suleiman, all coming up during the show. And live from the Green Space, it's Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution. With a room full of guests, many of whom have firsthand knowledge of past revolutions from all over the world, and listeners, you can call in as usual, 212-433-WNYC, and you can watch us as we feed live video of this event at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. And let's keep talking to all our witnesses to revolution. And as compelling as the current moment is, we've really come together today to look toward the future. So what did you see during the revolution that you witnessed that deserves to be remembered by history? What part did you play? Did the revolution turn out the way you had hoped? And based on your experience, what advice would you give to Egypt? Just raise your hands to tell your stories. A lot of people haven't gotten to speak yet. Just remember to identify yourselves for the radio audience. And let's go over here. We haven't heard from Suketu Metu yet. Hi.
Hi, I'm Suketu Metu. I am a writer and an NYU professor. And I was in India in the mid-1970s when Indira Gandhi suspended the constitution and declared a state of emergency. And people came out onto the streets in huge numbers, and they were led by veterans of the freedom struggle against the British. And looking at the Egyptian revolution, it seems to me that the revolution that they're inspired by is the Gandhian revolution of Satyagraha. In fact, while Ghanem said that his two heroes were Mahatma Gandhi and Mark Zuckerberg. So it seems to me
no
that what we're
there.
Seeing now in Egypt is a Gandhian revolution on fast forward for the internet age. And it's very important for the Egyptians to look at the Indian example and see that a nonviolent struggle, which is carried out through just means and produces a just end, can sustain the country for decades afterwards. So the one time when the constitution, when civil liberties were suspended in India, people didn't take it lying down. They went out into the streets. Indira Gandhi was forced to declare elections. And she came back to power 3 years later, but she couldn't get away with a dictatorship. And the other important thing for the Egyptians to remember is that the reason that India still is a democracy is that the army has never intervened in politics. And once you let the army in, they get comfortable with power. So I understand that the army is more liked than Mubarak in Egypt, but it's a dangerous thing to place your trust in the army.
Were there times in the Gandhi era struggle where the British turned violent against the crowd and the nonviolent resistance was able to prevail?
There were many times when the British put down any kind of defiance violently. There was the famous incident at Jallianwala Bagh where a British general fired upon a crowd of unarmed worshippers, killing hundreds of people. There were many times when the British jailed the freedom fighters, tortured people, all the things that the Mubarak regime is doing now. There's some kind of idea that the British were some kind of benevolent colonial rulers, and it wasn't always true. Gandhi was smart enough to figure out that we could not fight the British through force of arms, but there were more of us than there were of them. Once he said, if all the Indians in India spit in unison, we would form a puddle large enough to drown every Englishman in India. And I think the same might apply with the protesters.
Thank you, Suketu. Who else who hasn't spoken yet? Anybody back there?
Hi, I'm Shiva Sevram, founder and executive director of the Blossom Hill Foundation, which works with children of revolution. My perspective is that of a 6.5-year-old little girl, part of an upper middle class family, a secular one in Iran. And the change for us felt almost overnight. I mean, one minute we're going to school and we're on the playground, and the next minute, school is closed, we're standing in line for food, There's soldiers on the streets. So from a perspective of a child, it's absolutely terrifying. It's a very uncertain time. You don't know who to trust. Can you trust your neighbor? Are they for the new regime? Are they? So from a child's perspective, this is a very difficult time.
Can you give any advice to Egyptian parents?
You obviously try and create as much of the safety net that you can for your children. The reality is that kids are pretty smart. I could see the terror in my parents' eyes, to be honest with you. So, obviously our brothers and sisters in Egypt were all pulling for them. We encourage them not to give up, to fight for what's theirs, human rights, freedom, and to really fight for a secular democracy, because obviously that did not happen in Iran. 32 years later, it's still an Islamic
Thank you. And ma'am, right in front of you, right over there, you had your hand up, yes? You still want to speak?
Hi, my name is Didi Ogude, and I, much like the woman who just spoke, I was fairly young in South Africa when Mandela was released in 1990, and I distinctly remember him arm-in-arm with Winnie Mandela and standing in the street celebrating that moment. I think in terms of advice for Egyptians, I agree with my Indian colleague here about nonviolence and persisting in a peaceful way, because when you resort to violence, then your opponents can use that against you. But also what's really been important in South Africa is our constitution in sustaining our democracy. I think Egyptians should really think about and focus on the reform of their constitution, hopefully once Mubarak falls, because they need a legal system that will help sustain their democracy and help them vote out leaders in the future that they would want to or not.
So this is a leaderless revolution so far. There is no Gandhi. There is no Mandela. Does anybody think that matters, either for better or for worse? Yes, from the Philippines, there's no Corazon Aquino.
Yes, there's no Corazon Aquino. I find this incredibly inspiring. I would say to the Egyptians, this is the most inspiring and powerful moment of their revolution. One of the things that was the reason for the Philippine Revolution turning out to be a regime change rather than a full-on socioeconomic revolution was that there were too many interests in stabilizing, in establishing a so-called democracy, and in returning to business as usual. And therefore, this moment of it not being business as usual is the most powerful moment for the Egyptian people, because they have a chance to make so many changes that would otherwise be seeded if you think that the only problem is Mubarak and then installing another leader that will certainly guarantee a political regime change.
And right next to you.
Yes, hi. My name is Gladys Carbo Flower. I'm originally from Cuba. And I came here when I was 11. But I used to go back and forth, and I married. My first husband was Cuban. We happened to be in Havana for Christmas for December 58. We brought our firstborn, who's 4 months old, to meet his grandparents. And, of course, by then we knew the climate had gotten really dangerous. The parties were not being held at the clubs. People were having little private New Year's parties at home. And we left early, I think midnight or 1 or something, passed by the house. It was a lot of military people and all kinds of rifles and machine guns. And I know what it was, and he said, "Don't even look." We drove back. We're staying at my in-laws in Old Havana. And then we got a call about an hour or two later saying Batista has left the country. Now, the difference between, this leaderless thing is, I think, a blessing. Because you had in Cuba a Castro who had been percolating hatred all his life for a number of reasons. I mean, everything stopped because of him. He spent years in the University of Havana because he kept there were strikes all the time. That's why they started something called the University of Villanova, where I went, where I met my first husband. He was an ideologue, a megalomaniac, whose intent only in destroying. So you don't have that in Egypt. You have these you know, these people, these beautiful concepts of democracy.
A leader can lead it or a leader can steal it. We have a minute before the news. Sir, do you want to take that minute?
Well, yes. I'm Shinasi Rama. I happen to be one of the leaders and organizers of the movement against communism in Albania. So I have some first-hand advice because I have been advising and teaching on revolutions for a while. I teach at NYU. So the issue is simply this. This is a protest. It's not a revolution, simply because Tahrir is not Cairo, A. And B, it is not a leaderless revolution. It may appear like that. Leaders do not become leaders because they are personalities. They become leaders because others follow ideologies that they embrace. And in that sense, then, this is a unique case. It's a unique case because of the particular civilization where it's taking place. But
and I have to jump in because we have to break for the news, but we will let you expand on that thought later. Live from the Green Space, it's Advice to Egypt. What happens after a revolution? Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You can watch us live video streaming at itsafreecountry.org. Live from the Green Space here at WNYC, it's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution? And we seem to be broadcasting at the very moment that this transitions from a revolution to after a revolution. You heard the report. We don't know much right now. We're getting the word from the Associated Press and the BBC that President Hosni Mubarak does say he will step down from office. Incredible development after he dug in just last night. Good morning again, everyone. And if you would like to watch us here in the Green Space as we have a room full of amazing people to react to this news and to talk about the future, if you want to watch us, we are streaming live video at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. And there are many great people to look at. We have guests who have lived through, reported on, or studied revolutions from all over the world, from India and the Philippines to El Salvador and Cuba to Iran, South Africa, and the former Soviet Empire and beyond. They are comparing notes on how some revolutions turn out well and some not so well with an eye toward helping Egypt. And on stage with us now, Columbia University historian and New Yorker culture critic Simon Shama, author of, among many other things, his 1989 classic Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution, and NYU sociology professor Jeff Goodwin, who has studied social uprisings in the Philippines, South Africa, Central America, and more. His best-known book is No Other Way Out, States and Revolutionary Movements, 1945 to 1991. Welcome, both of you, to the Green Space.
Hello.
Thank you.
So, Simon, first, based on the word we're getting, after all that we saw yesterday, how can you explain that Mubarak turns around in a day, if these reports are true, and steps down after all?
Well, last night he was off his meds. They've put him back on them. I mean, it was a key moment, really, when Hossein Badrawi, I think, actually, was senior representative of the ruling party, was asked by a BBC correspondent, one of my colleagues at the BBC, Jim Muir, I think. So would you be utterly shocked if Mubarak was still president tomorrow? And he said, yes, I would be. And lo and behold, there was this extraordinary volte-face. And I think that we can only infer, but that was evidence of something very unexpected happening to what we might call... if not the counter-revolutionary command going on in the ruling tiers of the government, certainly the anti-revolutionary command. They're playing, I wish they weren't, in a way. You know, as has been said this morning, you know, the spectacle in Tahrir Square and in Alexandria is extraordinarily inspiring and moving and powerful. And all revolutions are comprised of comparable elements, but they do rewrite the rules very often. And the most one of the thrilling things about this is exactly, in the Middle East particularly, is rewriting the rules. But they have both the virtue of formless energy of this extremely moving sense of brotherliness, what the French in my modern revolution of the 1780s called fraternité, applied to both sexes, sort of. But the formlessness also does deprive you of cohesion. And doing the boring, both the charismatic things, you do have to have a leader of some sort, a Lafayette, a Lenin, a Mao, if you're going to actually harness this formless energy into pressure points against the class that's in power. You do need that. And you need to do even more appalling things for those of us in universities of labor with them. You need to help form committees. You actually do need to form committees. Mm. The Bolsheviks, we forget, were the most boringly powerful, brutal committee organizers of all. And so that's what the next stage may have in prospect. But the counter-revolutionaries are playing an exceptionally shrewd game. They've got Mubarak off somewhere on a deck chair in Sharm el-Sheikh. So the hope is, because the revolution was so focused on this one monster, you decapitate the monster and you say, You need to earn a living now.
And I think we now have a 30-second statement translated into English from what they are calling the presidency, an official announcement of the resignation. Let's listen.
Go back. During these difficult circumstances that the country is going through, President Mohammed Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from the office of President of the Republic and has charged the Higher Council of the Armed Forces to administer the affairs of the country. My God help everybody.
And I think we can bring up sound from Tahrir Square right now. No, I thought we could. We'll try to get to that in just a minute. Jeff Goodwin, how do you understand this? What could have happened in the last day? Is it possible that Mubarak and or the army thought yesterday that the announcement that he made last night would actually suffice and calm people and feel that he had done what he needed to do? And then they realized, oh, my God, that didn't work. What do we do now? Or what?
Well, I suspect Mubarak is just so out of touch that he had no inkling that that his statement would just add fuel to the fire. That's all I can guess. But if this is true, and I hope this is the final word on Mubarak's departure, I think what we're seeing here is the end of the beginning. And you said, well, we're entering a post-revolutionary phase. Well, I think in a real sense, the revolution has just begun at this point. And we're entering a stage in which there'll be a scramble for power, a fight for power. Elements of the old regime, counter-revolutionary elements, including the army, will be part of this fight. Elements within the movement are going to now be fighting for power. The unity that's been there is going to fracture. It's going to fracture starting this moment. What held it together, what glued this opposition together, was the common hatred and anger against Mubarak. Now that he's gone, all the conflicts of interest, all the disagreements, all the fissures in this vast coalition of people between the secular and religious, between right and left, moderates, labor, capital, they're going to come to the fore. We're going to see now the stage of reconsolidating a new regime.
I'm sure there's an incredible amount of emotion in the room right now among the Egyptians who are here having just heard this announcement. And Mona, who is tweeting away, we've been speaking, it seems like, every other day since the Tunisia revolution began, and I really need to hear how you feel right now.
I want to cry. I want to jump up and down. One of my friends just called me, and he's like, Mona, he's gone, and he was crying on the phone. This is the best day of so many of our lives. I can't believe it. I'm just ecstatic. It's wonderful. Wonderful.
And so, not to burst the bubble, but you heard what Jeff just said.
I don't want to hear it.
Do you want to just revel in it for the moment?
No, you know, I want to be realistic as well as kind of really love this moment. This is just the first step. We've said all along we want the regime to go. This is not about Mubarak. This is about getting rid of a regime that has suffocated the life of Egypt for the past 60 years. Egyptians deserve so much better. This is a wonderful moment in our life, and it's not going to stop. Everybody I know in Egypt is saying, we did it, but we're not going to stop. And I have total faith in them. I love Egypt, and I love being Egyptian today.
Thank you so much. For the courage to speak at this moment. Who else from our Egyptian contingent? Let's go back right over here.
Today everybody should be proud to be Egyptian. We're glad we got rid of Mubarak. It's time to get rid of all the old gods. And the Egyptian movement is not a movement to compare with any other movement in the world, because the whole universe is not just a chemical compound who can say this happened in this country or the other country. Egyptian persona is totally different. We cannot even put them in the Middle East as all one piece. Egyptians are different than Lebanese. We have to change our idea in the West that we compare everybody. Egyptians are not Iranian. Egyptians are not Israeli. Egyptians are not Lebanese. Egyptians are totally different making and different persona. And today everybody should be allowed to be Egyptian. And today I think we all should be Egyptian. Thank you.
Let's go back to the woman who's an Egyptian Coptic Christian who spoke a little earlier right here. Ma'am, how are you feeling right now?
The saddest day of my life, Wednesday night when I saw innocent, peaceful demonstrators sitting in Tahrir Square and they're getting shot at, and Molotov cocktails and all sorts of stuff and knives, and it was horrible. And today I want to pay condolences for every person who fell, the heroes who fell for Egypt. I owe them the freedom, and my children owe them, you know, to be proud to be Egyptian and to be proud to be part of their roots.
Thank you. Even Mubarak himself last night talked about the martyrs of this revolution. Sir.
Hi. My name is Zaid Saleh. I'm one of the founder for an organization called Egyptian Association for Change, which was responsible for all the protests that we had here in front of the United Nations and in Times Square last week. We started this organization a year ago after Dr. Baradi. He went to Egypt and he started the National Association for Change. And I just want to say that I really want it to be like optimistic, and I really want to be happy, but the people who, the young Egyptian who've been killed, they're not being killed by Mubarak, they're killed by the secret force and secret police. So I'm just trying to be the voice for all the young people in Egypt right now. I don't think this is not the end. This is just a start. Till we see all these cops been persecuted, all these cops in the jail, and they're going to be like a new system, you know, with a different name and different values, you know, I don't think we're going to be happy.
And we don't know yet if Suleiman is taking power, if somebody else from the army is taking power. Presumably all those words will come in as we continue. What do you think needs to happen right now, day one, hour one half?
I'm going to tell you what my friends actually believe in right now in Tahrir. They think that Suleiman, he's exactly Mubarak. He's another Mubarak. Suleiman, like, he agreed for all these people being killed, all these people being tortured. When we're talking right now, there are actually people right now being tortured, still being tortured. So this is not done. This is, like I said, this is just the start. And what I really think what should do, the army should step up and they should control all the country, and they should create a new government from the people that the Egyptian people they like. As an example, like Ayman Noor, like Hamdin Sabahi, like Dr. Baradi, they get all these people who were very, very helpful to their country for so many years, but unfortunately the regime and the media of the regime, they did create all this wrong image.
Thank you. Historian Simon Sharma, are there lessons from history for this moment? You talked about the ruthlessly efficient Bolshevik committee.
Right.
Is there a more positive example that Egypt can draw from right now?
Well, I just want to preface it by saying this minute in particular, I know the premise of our wonderful morning is advice, but it seems grotesquely presumptuous for us sitting here, armchair historians, really, to give people who've put their lives on the line for this moment of extraordinary liberation to be getting advice. However, also particularly because history, history wears a tragic face. I wish it didn't, actually. I mean, that's what it's done. And many revolutions do end in some form of military authoritarianism, like in the French Revolution, ultimately, as Benjamin Barber said, ended in Bonapartism. In the case of the Iranian Revolution, alas, ended in a kind of tyrannical theocracy. So this is a moment of extreme delicacy. And what actually I'd love to hear from our Egyptian friends here, I guess what puzzles me, I know the army have been saintly in some sense in protecting the protests in Tahrir Square, but armies are not elected. It's a conscript army. Their corporate collective instincts are usually nationalist and conservative, rather than something that really wants to see a free-flowing, open moment of constitutional change. And they will stay like soldiers are, used to taking and receiving orders, unless they're actually connected with civilians who are, you know, prepared to write constitutions and do all this dull stuff, which it takes to actually bring a new democracy to bear. There is one army, Brian, you know how modern I am about this thing, and that's England in 1649. You knew I was going to say that. That was Oliver Cromwell's army, and the army there were the midwives of as yet an unknown form of representative government. And that ended, of course, in the dictatorship.
So back to this gentleman who's Egyptian in our audience. What is all this trust of the army that we keep hearing from people?
The army in the past 3 days, over the time, but the past 3 days in particular, kept sending messages to the people saying, we're with you, we're going to make sure that your demands are met. Add this to the original trust more in the army than the police. The police was brutal. The police torturing people, arresting people without treason, including family members of army officers and soldiers. So there was always this rift between, or what it seems to be a rift between the army and the police, and sometimes the army had to put the police in the area in place. So anyway, that's could be the reason. Of course, I don't want to see a military rule, but and the wording of Mubarak's resignation is very crucial. It said, I'm delegating or giving it the leadership to the Supreme Council, not to Omar Suleiman. Well, if he resigns under the Constitution, does Omar Suleiman automatically become the leader of the Supreme Council or not? But anyway, I have to say that while Mona was taking her call, I also got a call from my mother in Egypt, jubilant, and cars are celebrating and beeping like as if it's a World Cup game or something. But I have to say, I'm very sad that he left right now. I wish it was an hour later when I say the two jokes about him not leaving. He ruined it.
And thank you very much. Listeners, if you're just joining us, Mubarak has resigned. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has announced that he is stepping down. It remains unclear to us at this moment, since this just happened a few minutes ago, who will be in charge in Egypt, and we are here live in the green space talking about what happens after a revolution with people from all around the world, literally, who are going to be here anyway, and they turned out to be in the room at the moment that we learned that Hosni Mubarak is resigning. Among our guests is the NYU sociology professor, Jeff Goodwin, who has studied social uprisings in the Philippines and South Africa and Central America and more, author of No Other Way Out, States and Revolutionary Movements, 1945 to 1991. Who can we draw from to go forward in a positive way right now? Your, you know, pre-interview with us before the show was so full of positive examples and negative examples.
Well, what I want to say, I think, is that in a sense we're seeing the downside of nonviolence, if I can put it that way. I mean, we all love nonviolent protests. No one wants to see people being killed in the streets. But when nonviolent protest succeeds, it means you still have to deal with the old regime. The old regime is still there. The ruling party is still there. And above all, the army is still there. So this kind of protest can be great at removing a dictator, but it doesn't remove, it doesn't necessarily remove the old regime. It doesn't get rid of the army. And so I think the army is going to be enormously important moving forward. Will it side with this faction or that? Will it try to take power on its own? Will it announce neutrality and step to the sidelines? This is, I think, the question that's going to determine the fate of this revolution going forward.
Simon Chama?
Here's the thing that is incredibly striking. This is, although it's a coalition of many different kinds of social groups, it is, as everybody is saying, here's Mona, the spirit of it, a revolution of the young. Revolutions very often make a cult of their youthfulness for the very good reason that you want Egypt, the oldest civilization in the world, one of them, to actually be reborn, to be young again. And this whole sense of rejuvenation is not just simply a poetic fantasy. The army high command, Suleiman being case in point, chief of intelligence, is old. Your bet you hope for, if you wish this revolution well and not to come to a bloodbath, and there are certain ominous signs even as we celebrate now, you want there to be a younger member of the military who is prepared to say, I am young Egypt. I am like you in the streets. I'm the embodiment of the rejuvenation, the youthful making of old Egypt. If you don't get that sort of person, you're going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place. The rock are the old guys, and the hard place is, a chaotically armed, rock-throwing set of defenseless people in Tahrir Square.
Yes, the beautifully leaderless revolution needs some leaders, and soon.
Right.
I want to offer some advice, but not to Egyptians. As a U.S. citizen, it's not my business to offer advice to Egyptians. But I would like to say something to my government. I think the Obama administration needs to make it crystal clear that the regime cannot remain in power. Any move to a military form of government is out of the question. The U.S. will not support military rule. It will not support continued rule by Suleiman and the ruling party. It must begin an immediate transition to some sort of broadly based transitional government that can prepare the way for democratic elections.
Gentleman right over here. Hi.
Hi. I'm Omar Shita, and I study history at NYU. I'm also Egyptian. Just to build up on the last three points about the army and its role, I agree with Hisham about this contrast with the police. Now, we learned recently about the army also being involved in detaining and other excesses. But I think the problem is, one big problem that we have to deal with now is that over 60 years, Egypt had no politics. And the return of politics that we're seeing now, I think, now we can see the confusion about the army. Many young people have served in the army. They feel closer to the army. And the army to them, yes, represents nationalism, but it doesn't represent nationalism in the way that we think about it here in Europe as some mild form of fascism. But it thinks of it as independence and national pride. The point that you said about the American government, I was just thinking that the army might be the only institution that is pro-American but also is seen as independent. So this might be a rare moment in which the American administration can actually tell the army could expect the army to act in a way that would not be seen as just being a ploy of the Americans.
And, when you think about the United States and popularity ratings of different institutions, Congress, low. The presidency, low. The media, low. Religious institutions, low. The army, high. The military is one of the most respected institutions here. I don't know how far the parallel goes.
But the army in the United States never took it upon itself to make a constitution.
Indeed. It's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, Advice to Egypt, What Happens After a Revolution. We have just learned that Hosni Mubarak has stepped down as president, but as we have also heard, it's only the end of the beginning. We'll continue live from the Green Space, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The Egyptian hip-hop artist Revolution Records singing about revolution. Here is the latest from Cairo. According to the Associated Press, just in, Egypt's Hosni Mubarak resigned as president and handed control to the military today, bowing down after a historic 18-day wave of pro-democracy demonstrations by hundreds of thousands. A massive crowd in Cairo's central Tahrir Square exploded into joy, waving Egyptian flags and car horns, and celebratory shots in the air were heard around the city of 18 million in joy after Vice President Omar Suleiman made the announcement on national TV just after nightfall. Quote from the president, this is Suleiman speaking, in these grave circumstances that the country is passing through, President Hosni Mubarak has decided to leave his position as President of the Republic. He has mandated the Armed Forces Supreme Council to run the state. God is our protector and succor, unquote. Nobel Peace Laureate Mohamed El-Baradei, whose young supporters were among the organizers of the protest movement, told the Associated Press, "This is the greatest day of my life." I think we heard the same from Mona El-Tahawi here in the room a short time ago. "The country has been liberated," he said, "after decades of repression." And El-Baradei added that he expects a beautiful transition to power. And that is what we are here to talk about in this special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, live in the Green Space. What happens after a revolution? Will it be a beautiful transition to power, or might it not? And again, if you're just joining us and you would like to watch this live event from the Green Space at this historic moment, you can do so. We are live streaming video on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Joining us now on our stage, we have for this next stretch one of the world's foremost experts on democracy building. Benjamin Barber is president and director of the Interdependence Movement and the organization CivWorld for the think tank Demos here in New York. He blogs on Huffington Post and has been a Rutgers and University of Maryland professor. He has consulted governments, including Libya and Syria, on democracy building and is the author of books including Strong Democracy, Participatory Politics for a New Age from 2004, and Jihad versus McWorld, How Globalism and Tribalism Are Reshaping the World. By the way, Jihad versus McWorld was published 5 years before 9/11. Benjamin Barber, welcome back to WNYC and welcome to the Green Space.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So, a beautiful transition to power, hopes Mohamed El-Baradei.
It's such, as Simon Shamus said, it's a very delicate moment because in a way this is a day we should do nothing more than just celebrate for our Egyptian brothers and sisters, for the extraordinary victory that they've won, and in a way for analysts to sit back and, I won't say throw cold water, but remind them of history is not really an appropriate thing at this moment, and yet in the long term one has to do it. My research assistant at Demos said to me yesterday, he's about 25, "This is my first revolution." And he was so excited, and I appreciated that, you know, that for all of us to be here this morning talking about it on a day when actually a revolution not only has taken place, but a first step to victory to start. But, and I do think we need, for the sake of what's going on in Tahrir Square and in Cairo and in other parts of the Middle East, we have to step back a little bit because in one sense, it's an extraordinary victory that the president is gone. In another way, it's the worst thing that could have happened, because it removes the immediate object of rage and scorn from the scene and makes it easy to forget that the people still there, Field Marshal Tantawi, Prime Minister Shafiq, and of course Suleiman himself, will now be the ruling council for at least another 6 months, and following that, we don't know. It's easy to forget that the army there receives $1.3 billion in aid, more than any other country in the world except Israel, from the United States. It's easy to forget a word that hasn't been said this morning, Suez Canal. I mean, the last time somebody messed with the Suez Canal, France and England invaded Egypt in 1956, and actually it was General Eisenhower who said, whoa, 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 we can't be doing this. But the fact is, Egypt is not in a position in this interdependent world simply to do what the dictates of Tahrir Square suggest. And if the revolution is to succeed, it has to be understood that this was not just the first step, but the easy step.
And you wrote on Huffington Post this week, "The dilemma is real. Revolution and democracy are often at odds. What liberates a people from tyranny doesn't always lead them to freedom." So, as a democracy theorist, and with that in mind, and knowing where Egypt is starting from, what do they need to do to build toward a successful, truly democratic outcome?
Well, I think to remember the distinction I made earlier between a political regime change and a socioeconomic revolution, because we also haven't heard a lot this morning about Egypt's dire socioeconomic conditions. Half the population or more is under 21 or even under 16. A lot of people, millions and millions, are educated without jobs, and there are millions of others who have not been educated and have no jobs. There is an underlying situation. This has been a middle class, a wonderful middle class expression, but there are a lot of very, very poor people there, and their interests, who will represent them? How even can they be represented? What if tomorrow we had a government of the people in Tahrir Square? How would they address the question of widespread unemployment, education but no jobs? Are they going to create the jobs? How do they do it without the West? And if they need the West, which I think they do in the United States, then they have to be careful. It's a complex and difficult situation. I know it feels like cold water to say these things, but now that the Egyptian people have been so successful, remarkably successful in the first stage, they have to be ready for the second, much harder stage, because when you're not ready for that, then this could be the Kerensky moment of the Egyptian revolution, where everyone says, a gentle socialism will replace the czars, and Russia will be ruled by social democracy, when the Bolsheviks were waiting in the wings, as Simon said, with their brilliant organizational capacity to take over the Soviets, the workers' councils, and make their own revolution.
And for our guests on this side of the green space from all over the world, we want to hear from you on this. This is that next moment, treacherous moment for Egypt, as everybody knows. As you're preparing your next comments, I'll just say that in his important book, Illiberal Democracy, The Future of Freedom at Home and Abroad, Fareed Zakaria reminds us that the Germans elected Hitler in 1933, that many countries declared themselves democracies immediately after their revolutions and fell back into dictatorship within 10 years, and that we have to look past just elections from day one, he says, to also make sure they're building the rule of law and separation of powers, like an independent judiciary, freedom of assembly for strong private organizations, liberalizing economies as well as governments, and more. So let's turn to this gentleman whose experience is from Albania, which, of course, went post-communist in 1989. Hello.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I would say that every revolution has one goal, and the goal is to capture the state and control the state. At this point in Egypt, we have a junta. Basically, the emergency law guaranteed that the president would be just, the face of the regime, Mubarak, but in reality, the power was wielded from the military base. But what happened right now has really opened a can of worms that is that is very dangerous for revolution, quote unquote, or protests in Egypt, but also for the national interests of the United States. Revolutions are won by three distinctive groups that have three distinctive characteristics. They have structure, they have leadership, and they have external support. And in this case, the only groups that do have these three characteristics coming from a variety of sources are not the people in the Tahrir Square, but are the military, is the Muslim Brotherhood, and, of course, the structure of the Nationalist Party. So what I would say is that by decapitating the regime and by making Mubarak a scapegoat, now we have a junta, there is no reason for the protest to continue as is, and the reason why I called it a protest, not a revolution, is very simple. We didn't see wide popular mobilization everywhere. There are, you know, 15 squares like Tahrir Square in Cairo alone. And we didn't see these people going to mobilize workers, mobilize the secondary elites and tertiary elites, which means village teachers and professionals, etc. This was a protest of upper middle classes supported by, backed up by the Islam, by Muslim Brotherhood, and by segments of the elite that were dissatisfied with Mubarak. This is the nightmare now where the game is starting, because the opposition doesn't have the structure. And the U.S., in my view, I think that Professor Goodwin made some great points, but at this point, you know, I'm an American citizen too. I think that my government should not be tweeting on this issue. The U.S. government should get out of this game. Egypt is very important, but we should want the truth to win. We want what the people of Egypt wants to win, but we cannot tweet every move and every play in the game. Yes.
Shinasi Rama, speaking there from NYU's Center for Political Economy. Mona El-Tahawi, you were shaking your head in disagreement about the nature of the revolution.
I want to remind our friend that one of the inspirations for this revolution, and I maintain it's a revolution, was a series of labor strikes, basically, by textile workers in a town called Mahal al-Kubra in northern Egypt in 2008 that was instrumental in launching the April 6th youth movement, which was one of the instigators of this revolution. And we've seen over the... A lot of people think that it's just Tahrir Square. It's certainly not. Just because the media have focused on Tahrir Square doesn't mean Egyptians across the country haven't joined. Labor workers, unions in Suez, in Mahalla, in Mansoura, people from my father's town in southern Egypt, the very conservative part of Egypt, this is not a Cairo-led movement. This is a nationwide revolution against Mubarak.
Who else? Suketu Mehta, let's come back to you.
Well, I'm feeling incredibly inspired by the Egyptian people, and I am very happy to be alive today. And as a New Yorker, I would like to remind us that in this city, 1% of the people make 45% of the city's income. So the average individual in this group, in this 1%, makes more than the average annual income of people in the bottom 10%. The United States, in some ways, is a more unequal society than Egypt. In Egypt, 89 out of 100,000 people are behind bars. In the United States, it's one out of every 100 adults, 70% of them non-white. So I wait for the Twitter and Facebook messages summoning a million people to Times Square. And Mona, pass your baton on to us.
And behind you, yes. Please identify yourself.
Hi,
again.
Gladys Carver-Flower. I'll be very brief. I hate to throw cold water on this, but I have to say Suleiman has little to recommend him. So I don't think that one can be completely happy if he's part of the picture. And the army, as nice as they've been, I don't trust anybody with a gun. If you need to make a point with a gun, you haven't got a point. And that's all.
And yes, and please identify yourself again.
Nefertiti Tadiar. I was in the 1986 revolution in the Philippines, but I've also written about it. I teach at Barnard College. I do not want to throw any cold water on the Egyptians at this moment. I remember my own experience. It was the most exhilarating experience in my life. It has defined my politics. It has defined politically all of my involvements. And I think this is the moment that must not just be let go. I think this is democracy at work. Yes, everything that I said earlier about the military, about the betrayal, about the seizure of power, about ceding power to a leader that will, you know, reinstall business as usual in the interests of a very lucrative state structure,
You know, there's plenty of a profit to be gained by taking over this state as it is. But I think for the young people who are in Egypt, democracy is to continue making the demands. They will not all have the same demands, but to continue doing it. The one regret that I have after the 1986 revolution was that ordinary people felt that our job was done. Not everybody did. Many people joined the government. Many people tried to do things. But at the same time, you know, there was so much power in the people. And it is no less now that Mubarak is gone than when it started. And you can hold the military to that power. You can make it accountable. And what we didn't do is to keep making the government, the military, all of the forces who wanted to take away the gains of the revolution, we did not completely make them accountable to us.
Benjamin Barber, democracy building expert. We've just heard a lot.
A lot and of great, great interest. And Mona just left the room to tweet again, I think. But I really wanted to address this to her because she said earlier, we are not naive. Yes, you are, and that is the best compliment you can pay people. Without innocence, without naivete, without freshness, and without hope, there would never be any political change. If everybody in the world were political scientists like me, we'd look at tragic history and say, forget about it. It's never going to work. It never has. And the comment this gentleman just made is so right. 225 or 30 years after the American Revolution, there's more inequality in America than there's in a lot of other places. Now, on the one hand, you know, we can say, well, isn't that terrible? We can also say, so much for democratic revolution. This is the seat and theater of democratic revolution. We haven't made it work here, which means it's going to be very tough in a place that has so much inequality, that has so much unemployment, to make it work. So I think we need to combine the fresh hope of naivete, youth, and innocence with the reality that to make fundamental changes historically is extremely difficult. And for that reason, the Egyptian people have to be ready for a long, long struggle, not one that ends with the overthrow of this particular dictator.
We'll continue and finish up with our last few minutes from the green space coming right up. Ryan Lehrer on WNYC with our special edition as Hosni Mubarak steps down. He's stepped down this hour. It's advice to Egypt. What happens after a revolution? Stay with us. Egyptian singer, Umm Kulthum. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the green space. It's advice to Egypt, what happens after a revolution, with a room full of guests representing past revolutions from all over the world. You can watch us as we feed live video of this event at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. And when we're done here in about 10 minutes, then we will put a live video feed from Tahrir Square up on It's a Free Country. And again, if you haven't heard, Egypt's Hosni Mubarak resigned as president less than an hour ago and handed control to the military, bowing out after the historic 18-day wave of pro-democracy demonstrations. For these final minutes, let's give everyone in the room a chance to ask questions of anyone else in the room, any of our witnesses or experts. You can ask anyone else, paid ticket holders in the audience. You can ask a question of anyone who has spoken, anyone who has something yet to say, who hasn't gotten it in. You can say it. It is a historic moment in the world, and I'm glad that we've been able to gather you all here in the green space to share it. Ma'am, right there.
Hello, my name is Dominique Ellis, and I'm Fulbright. I just returned from Egypt. So I was there. This is my first revolution as well, and I was there for the first 10 days of the events unfolding. And for me, I guess I question why we believe what Mubarak says in this moment. I've become very skeptical in terms of just a lot of the lies that he's said over the last 2 weeks. And, you know, I think it would be interesting to hear some other thoughts from other people.
Thank you very much. Ann Nelson, who's covered revolutions in Central America and teaches at the International and International Affairs Program at Columbia.
Yeah, I covered the political events in Central America, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, from 80 to 83. So it was like case studies in different stages of uprisings and revolutions. Nicaragua, we used to say that it was a revolution by graduate students, and all of a sudden they held power. And quite frankly, they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know how to run an economy. They didn't know how to create a state. And one of the things I admire about what's going on in Egypt is that even though the United States has given Mubarak a lot of support over the years and has turned a blind eye to his human rights abuses, it doesn't seem to be an anti-American oriented protest. And I feel that that was a mistake that the Sandinistas made. As soon as they got into power, the anti-American rhetoric created a level of noise that made it very difficult for them to proceed to construct a society. You can almost contrast that to Costa Rica in the 1940s when Pepe Figueres won a revolution. What he did was actually dissolve the army and invest huge amounts of money in education and health care and various reforms. And now, looking in hindsight, Costa Rica is the one really successful state in the region.
Can Egypt, given its position in the Middle East, be Costa Rica, or is that just unrealistic?
It cannot. But at the same time, if I were looking at Egypt now, I'd say some structural reforms investing in basics like education and health care would go a long way no matter who inherits the regime.
Thank you. Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs.
I think what you've seen in the last few minutes or whatever is the military moving from indirect control of Egypt to direct control. And that is a major step forward in some respects because Mubarak was in many respects a very bad man who did very bad things. And getting him out of there is not the end of the existing regime in Egypt by any means, but it is progress in a significant way. And I think that there's a middle line between we need to topple the entire regime to get any progress and, oh my God, there's going to be chaos or everything will be just the same. The fact is that getting rid of Mubarak can be a step forward. It's not yet a change of regime. And the next 6 months, in some respects, will be very crucial, not just the next couple of days or weeks, because there's no real alternative yet to the existing power structures in Egypt. And the question we now is, how is the military regime that is now going to be in place directly going to move forward? If they try to maintain the entire power structure, they'll just reproduce the same problems that Mubarak ran into. And how can we help them move forward gradually so that there isn't chaos, but there is progress?
Youssef Ibrahim, former New York Times bureau chief in Tehran during that revolution.
It seems to me one of the important things to think about is what America should do to support this earthquake in Egypt. And clearly we haven't really gotten into the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood could become the biggest threat to this revolution, the one party that really turns a glorious triumph into some kind of new neo-fascist thing. I believe America should not stay on the sideline now. America should make it a point to see that this revolution continues without being stolen.
Thank you. Benjamin, Benjamin Barber.
Very quick. We haven't talked about Turkey. Turkey's a great example for Egypt. The army there played for 60 years a major role. It backed off. A moderate Islamist party came to power. The army in the background prevented it from getting too revolutionary, too Islamist. That's been a very good thing. I think the Muslim Brotherhood could be part of a solution with the army in the background as a kind of break on moving too far. But I think we don't want to exercise Islamophobia here and say because it's the Muslim Brotherhood, they shouldn't have a role to play. They deserve a role to play. They are representative, and a Turkish model is something to think about.
Shanasi, briefly?
I would say that the only real meaningful structure within the civil society that has the power to really mobilize people, throw them in, you know, and find the support to be a political party in the true sense is the Muslim Brotherhood, regardless of their embrace of human rights and whatnot. For tactical purposes, their strategy is very clear. And we all know, at least us who study revolutions and participate in them, that whenever you have to mobilize people, you have to go to certainties. And certainties are always identities. And the identity in this case is something that only Muslim Brotherhood is able to provide, with 20% of support under a very authoritarian and dictatorial regime. Imagine what will happen when it becomes democratic. Thank
Jeff
you.
Goodwin, NYU sociologist of revolutions.
Yeah, I think the solution to the threat of the Brotherhood, the solution to the threat of dictatorship is organization, organization, organization. This is what's popular organization that can permanently represent the interests of the Egyptian people is the only solution here. And I think with the fall of Mubarak, I hope with his fall, we're going to enter a period of rapid organization, self-organization. Unions are going to explode. I hope popular organizations, political parties, that's the only way to keep the pressure on the old regime, keep the pressure on the military, push the Islamists to the side, and have a more popular and representative democracy.
Mona El-Tahawi, you get our last 20 seconds.
I think what this revolution has done is it's smashed many myths, and one of the biggest myths that it has smashed is that only the Muslim Brotherhood can bring out those feet, the feet on the street, to stand up to the regime. We've seen another kind of revolution that can bring the feet out. The Muslim Brotherhood will be involved, but they did not push this revolution. This revolution is of Egypt, not the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, this has been an incredible 2 hours. Thanks to everyone here. We always try to do not just news, but community building. It is rare that so many different people from so many different backgrounds get together in one space, and I think in this case with one unifying goal to promote freedom and democracy. I also want to thank the incomparable Green Space team and the Brian Lehrer Show producers and the itsafreecountry.org editors. Listeners, we have a discussion page that you can hang out all day if you want at itsafreecountry.org. We're also putting up a live video feed from Tahrir Square right there, right now, itsafreecountry.org. We will also carry President Obama's statement when it comes. It is expected around 1:30 this afternoon. And stay tuned for the Leonard Lopate Show with more coverage. Have a great weekend, everyone. Live from the Green Space, I'm Brian Lehrer.